Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thank you for listening to Susie Larson Live. Faith Radio podcasts are only possible because of your support. So thanks for giving, and thanks for sharing with a friend. It's only just a matter of... Welcome to Susie Larson Live. Always so honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, many of you know that I spoke at a conference this past weekend where the conference director, who was also the senior pastor's wife, who also served as the children's minister, was tragically killed last week when she was out running. And after much prayer, the team decided to move ahead with the conference. And a number of you said you were praying for me and wanted to know how it went. You know, Scripture says that precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints. And I got to tell you, we stepped into the most sacred grief space we've ever been a part of. I can't even explain it. On one hand, they felt deeply confident that Marie would have wanted them to move ahead with this conference, yet they were just in the throes of grief. But there were people coming from other communities for this conference as well, and they're an outreach type of church. I can't even explain what it was like, but what I can tell you is that heaven is so near. When God comes to take His children home, heaven is so near. It's just, you had this palpable sense of eternity just hovering overhead. Pastor David, he's a senior pastor. This is a rural community, and he heard the sirens, and he knew somehow where his wife was running because she was training for a marathon. And he drove to the scene. And he knew somehow his wife was in that ambulance. But before he went to the ambulance, the young man that had hit her, the man wasn't speeding. He wasn't on any alcohol or drugs. It was a blind spot. It was an honest accident. It's a dangerous spot on the way the highway dips and then comes up to a hill. That man, young man was standing there weeping, sobbing, going, "I'll never be forgiven. I'll never be forgiven." And so Pastor David bypassed the ambulance where he knew his wife had passed, wrapped this man up in an embrace, wept with him and said, "You are forgiven. You are forgiven. And Jesus wants you in His kingdom. You take this moment to trust Jesus for your salvation." He ministered to him. And two of the police officers knew who Pastor David was, but the others just knew of him as a local pastor. They had no idea that his wife was the one in that audience. The church right now is recounting all the ways that God has been preparing them for this loss. I mean, over and over again, we heard one story after another behind the scenes of how God has been preparing them. They couldn't see it at the time, but they see it now. Here's an example. Marie, Pastor David's wife, she delivered the message on Palm Sunday, and the title of her message was "Preparing to Die." And it was based on Jesus' words in John 12:24. "I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat is planted in the soil and dies, it remains alone. But its death will produce many new kernels, a plentiful harvest of new lives." Wow. Marie, several months ago, had a dream about the worship leader. She was the one leading the worship at this conference, and she went up to her weeping and crying, saying, "I had a vivid dream, and it wasn't at our church. We were at a different building, but we were all together, but there were folks in the community, and worship was so powerful, it just reverberated, and God was near." And through her tears, the worship leader said, "I think that Marie had a dream and got a glimpse of her own funeral." Pastor David had developed relationships with other churches in the community across denominational lines. That's what he was known for. So when tragedy struck this church, the other churches stepped in. They loved him. That's how this is supposed to go. That's what the church is supposed to look like. So this funeral in this rural town was filled with people across denominational lines. There's so much more that I could say, but I'll say this. When God brings one of His children home, it's not happenstance. It's not happenstance. God prepares the way. Even if we can't see it in the moment, and maybe we won't recognize it until we look back like these people are, they're looking back going, "We see all the ways, all of the hints, all of the clues God was giving us that this was coming. We couldn't see it then, but we see it now, and we feel cared for by God." Kevin and I cried on our way home that we could have such an honor to minister to these precious hearts during their time of grief. It leaves me speechless. I guess I just wanted you to be encouraged. Live with eternity in mind. Love others well. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. You know, none of us knows if we have tomorrow, but we have today. You don't want to live with regrets. You don't want to harbor grudges. You don't want to nurse unforgiveness. You want to live with eternity in mind. God cares so much about his children, and he doesn't just wing this. He plans and purposes. And what the enemy means for evil, God somehow, some way, always turns it for good. Well, we happen to be talking today about what death can teach us about life. J. Warner Wallace is my guest today, and his new book is titled The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. When the story I shared, no crime was committed. But I was thinking as I was prepping for today's show, when Jesus died, a crime was definitely committed. And yet, God even prepared the way for his death. He dropped seeds into the soil that the disciples would understand, looking back in hindsight. What does death teach us about life? We'll get Jim on in a moment. Quick announcement first. If you've not downloaded our app, you got to do it. It's free. And that way you can travel anywhere and listen live. My hubby and I were driving 3 hours to this event, and he just whipped up that app, hooked it up to his Bluetooth speaker in his car, and we had perfect reception the whole way. It was fantastic. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. J. Warner Wallace is a Dateline featured cold case detective, author, speaker, senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, adjunct professor of apologetics at Talbot School of Theology at Biola University and Southern Evangelical Seminary. We love him and appreciate any time we get with him. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. It's hard to kind of listen to the story, and it makes you like wonder. I'm sure there were people, and I'm sure there are people who probably are listening to this who maybe aren't Christians who are wondering, well, what kind of people would continue an event when they could easily cancel it? And I think that really kind of reveals our view, our larger view about the nature of life, right? I mean, if life is just the 90 years you get to live on planet Earth, then nobody wants that to be cut short, and it'd be a true tragedy if someone dies in their 30s, 40s, 50s, because the expectation is you're going to get 90. And that's only, of course, the case if that description of life is accurate, right? If life's just a line segment that runs from birth to death, well, then you've got a reason to really – we don't believe that as Christians. As an atheist, I believe that for 35 years. But that as a Christian, you know that life's not, it's different geometry. It's not a line segment. Yeah. It's a ray. It starts at birth. It goes through that point we call death, and it continues infinitely into the future. And that's that perception changes everything. And studies show this. It turns out that people are hopeless, often hopeless, and they will talk about the things, and they're surveyed. And this is one chapter of the book where you see the hopelessness in people, especially when you're working murders, where it feels like, especially cold cases, where it seems like decades have gone by and no one's working the case and nobody cares and there's no progress and is it ever going to get solved? And you work those kinds of cases and you see hopelessness firsthand in families, and you find yourself kind of working for the family. You know, you're not working for your agency. Your agency is happy if you do something, do anything. They don't care. But to be honest, you pick these cases because you want to solve them and you want to help families understand the nature of life. And you get this hopelessness, but it turns out that people who hold a worldview, and this is what the secular science says, if you hold a worldview in which you have a notion of the persisting self, in other words, that you don't just die and go back in the dirt, because then your self would not persist beyond the grave. You're not reincarnated, because then you would persist, but not the self you know today, some other self. If instead you persist as the self who has all the memories and all the experiences you have today, and that persists beyond the grave, people who hold that view have less hopelessness. It's just the truth.
Yeah.
And so when this kind of tragedy occurs, you're actually able to stop. And of course we grieve. We're going to grieve. We don't grieve like people who have no hope, though.
Yeah.
And that's because we know that there's a self that persists beyond the grave. Of all these worldviews that can provide what the secular researchers call the persisting self, well, the Christian worldview does the best job, because it actually provides that kind of that notion of eternity. So I'm not surprised that even though it's his wife's, she was the director, she was the one who planned the conference, that she was going to be, I mean, you would think this is surely we could cancel this. But I'm not surprised they wouldn't, because we're not without hope. We know that if atheism is true, then she wouldn't know if we canceled it or not. But if Christianity is true, of course, she's still alive, and we're doing this because we know that she wants us to do it. Not that she would have wanted us to do it, but that she actually wants us right now because
Wow.
she's still alive to
Come
want us
on.
to do it.
That's
There's a big
amazing.
difference between those two things, right? Well, she would
Yes,
have wanted
yes.
us to, and no, she wants us to.
Wow.
So that's the
That's
difference.
amazing. That's amazing. Kev got to just wrap up the pastor in a hug. They cried together, but a number of people told me behind the scenes, his worship, his arms were in the air during the funeral. He worshiped down to his toes. And he told us, he said, "I love her. They're young. I think they're in their mid-30s, late-30s, maybe. They're
Isn't
young.
that
They have
great,
young
though,
kids."
Susie, that we look at that and
Yeah.
we say, oh, that's
Yeah.
young. You know,
Yeah, right.
that's because
That's another show. We'll talk
we
about
just
that
gave
later.
ourselves away a little bit there. Yeah,
Totally,
no,
yes.
I'm with you. But you know,
Yes. Yeah.
look what Job does, right? Job doesn't even know the first two chapters of Job, it sets out why Job's about to suffer. But Job doesn't get to read the first two chapters of Job.
That's
So he
right.
has no idea why he's about to suffer. And then he is struck in a way that is just none of us will probably ever know what it was to be like Job. And what is his first response? Worship. Isn't that interesting?
Amazing.
And
That's
I
true.
think that
Yeah.
since antiquity, that people who get it, who know there's a God that held this worldview of the persisting self, their first inclination is to worship, even in hardship.
Yeah.
Because, and it's so interesting to me in Job, here's the entire, it's like what, 40 plus chapters of dialogue back and forth, and Job talking again and again and again, and never once does he pray to God, heal me. Instead, he just wants to know why, God, why? In other words, Job is not so concerned with himself that he just wants to be healed and move on. He wants his stuff returned and move on. He wants his family, he's not asking for that. He wants to know, what have I done, Father, that has offended you? Because I don't think I've done this, but anything to deserve this. Isn't that interesting that his first response is, are we still good? That's his first response. Are we still good? That to me is the difference between, and I think that's what gives me hope also going forward, right? Is this that I know that you have a relationship with the Father, and that it's not about, throwing yourself on just the mercy of the Father because we're doing that, but it's also that the justice of sin has been paid on the cross. So,
Yes, his story is so amazing. I think about that point when he repented. He didn't repent because the friends were right about him. He
yeah,
repented because he was wrong about God. Because he
that's
got to
right.
a point where he started to accuse God, right? I mean, I feel like that's a picture of we all have that limit where we get pushed far enough where then we go, but all I've done and where are you? And anybody's going
Yeah.
to get there at some point. I would say his threshold is far beyond most any other human on the
Well, and
planet.
isn't it interesting too? Now we're talking about Job here the whole time, but this is important. I mean, isn't it interesting that it's his friend's pitilessness that is part of his suffering? It's not just that he loses
Exactly.
all this. It's
Yeah.
that on top of all that, he's got friends who are seem like they know everything, and those are the one, by the way, it's that interaction back and forth that drives him to eventually shake his fist even harder.
Yeah.
And that's and
Yeah.
so we can we have to make a choice as friends. We do a lot of Susie and I, my wife Susie and I, we work at Billy Graham Association doing a lot of marriage resiliency for officers, police officers who have been critically injured or involved in critical incidents, and they're suffering and they're struggling in their marriages. And you find yourself, trying to look at Job as a model of this, as how does our Christian worldview help us how does death change our lives? And a lot of what I've written about in this book really comes out of those experiences we've had with couples trying to figure out and who are suffering and really kind of sometimes angry at God. Is there a God? A lot of them come up there, they don't know God at all. And we're just trying to introduce them to a truth claim that will change their lives.
It's amazing to me before we go to break, thinking about Job again. We prayed before the show, God lead us where you want us to go. Neither of us expected this part of the conversation, but
Right.
when I think about, his instinctive response to unbelievable tragedy was worship. I mean, he didn't blame God. He went face down. I mean, his threshold is far beyond anything I've ever seen in anybody on planet Earth. But again, as anybody would, he got to that point where he was angsty as anybody would be. But again, when he got to that next place where he professed, I knew about you, but now I've seen you. That was before his own life was redeemed. It was when he had an encounter with God as he is and not as he seemed. Do you know what I mean? He received an upgrade of who God was to the point where he's like, I once heard about you. Now I have seen you. That's when
much of what he lost, right, was relationships with his family. Yes. But the relationship that mattered the most, that caused him to anguish the most, was his relationship with God.
Yeah. He didn't know all the restoration was coming after.
That's right.
The priority for him was that relationship. Right. Yeah. And boy, that's really a big takeaway we can get from Job's stories. When, you know, so my friend once said, life has a way of lifing you. And when you've been lifed by life and you feel out of sync, discombobulated, disoriented, and you find yourself blaming God for the stuff that the enemy's guilty of, this is when you want to find your footing again. So we kind of hit the ground running. When we come back, Jim, I want to ask you the question I normally ask at the open of the show. What has God been talking about these days? And maybe you just were talking about it, but I'm still going to ask the question. And then we're going to dig into J. Warner Wallace's book. We've got a handful of copies to give away. The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. If you really like apologetics, if you like true stories and just kind of investigative journalism almost, where he's unpacking these crimes, these stories, and then making a biblical parallel to what we can learn through death about life. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. This is Susie Larson, host of Susie Larson Live. Maybe you have a loved one that you've been praying for years, and they still haven't trusted Jesus. Or maybe you have a loved one who once had a vibrant faith, but has since walked away. If this is true for you, know this, you're not alone. God sees you, He loves you, and He knows about the heartache you feel. And we care about it too. I've recorded 15 audio clips to encourage your soul. Text the word heart to 877-933-2484. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live, talking to our friend J. Warner Wallace about his new book, The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. This book is just packed with insight. Got a handful of copies to give away. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. Okay, Jim, maybe you already answered the question because we kind of hit the ground running, but I still got to ask. It's just in your times with God these days, what's He been impressing upon your heart?
Well, can you tell that I'm studying through Job right now?
Yeah, chapter, there you right? go.
You know, I've done it before and had studies that kind of I just follow along. And this is the first time I'm really digging through each chapter and each line of each, chapter to try to – because a lot of it is wanting to do a better job because we're getting ready to go in the summer. We spend 6 weeks with these couples in marriage resiliency. Mm-hmm. And so much of what I learned in doing that over the last 5 years is in this book. And a lot of it comes down to, you wrote a book, a great book called Your Beautiful Purpose. And this is that's a book that is really hits there's a chapter in my book. So it's 15 true crime stories, 15 rules for life, 15 ways that the Bible describes us the way we really are. So, my stuff is mostly Christian apologetics in the past, but the last couple of books have really been about what is so beautiful about Jesus and Christianity, because I think the questions are changing for people. It's not just, is it true? And that's important. If you're a boomer like me, that was important. I'm not going to jump into a system that I don't think is even true. But I think that's changing for the next generation. It's really more about, is it good? And it is both true and good. So I think this is where I wanted to focus. So these 15 stories, one of them deals with identity. And if you look at studies on identity, they're almost inseparable from studies on purpose, about purpose and value, because purpose and value are so closely connected to identity. And part of when I see we start to suffer, we see this in officers where they suffer a critical incident and it changes the way they see themselves. If you were to go back and look at your life, Susie, all the places where you and I have valleys, places where we're like, oh, that was kind of a low point. I guarantee if you go back to that point and look at it closely, you'll discover that there was a point there where you, how you saw yourself changed. Oh, I'm a married person. Oh, no, I'm divorced now. Or I'm somebody who had this job. I got fired. I had to rethink who am I? And every time we are forced to rethink who we are, we're going to struggle some, suffer some trauma. And every time we suffer trauma, we're going to end up, some aspect of that is to be, I used to be healthy. Now I've got cancer. I mean, you're rethinking your identity. And so if nothing else, if you could place your identity in something that's not likely to change abruptly, you will suffer less trauma. And a lot of what I'm seeing in these officers is that they've now can't work. They lost, they've been critically injured. Who am I? I found the same thing. And this one chapter talks about how, you know, I felt that way when I retired. Like, who am I now when I drive off that lot for the last day? You know, I gave my uniforms to my son. I have my badge, but, you know, a lot of times officers, they'll take your badge and they'll put it in and encase it in plastic. Like you're like in mothballs. I mean, who am I now? And that struggle for identity. And so I think it's important for us to teach young people, especially, and that's what this book really is designed for both young and old. I mean, I think the high schoolers can learn a lot from a book like this. But the idea is, if you're going to form your identity the way that cultures are forming identity right now, get ready for some trauma, because there's only three ways you can form identity: outside in, inside out, and topside down. That's it. And I kind of go through those in the book, but the most current way is to look inside yourself and ask yourself, who am I? Who do I think I am? What are my desires? What do I like? What am I good at?
What are my feelings?
What are my sexual preferences? I mean, all of these things. And then we tell the world around us, okay, this is who I am. And I want you to identify me the way that I see myself. It's very different than the ancients. The ancients looked outside themselves and they said, what tribe do I belong to? What clan? What nation? What ethnicity? What profession? These are things that are outside of us that preceded us often that we latch onto. We look outside and grab them in. Two different ways of forming an identity. And both of those ways, they are moving targets. Your heart will change many times. Your desires will change. Get ready for an identity change then. Or you could lose your job. You can these things on the outside. There's a better, more stable way to form your identity. And of course, that is to look up. It's topside down identity. Because if your identity is in Christ, this unchanging, transcendent God of the universe, well, then if nothing else, it's not going to abruptly change. You know, when you lose your job, you're still that child of Christ you were the day you had the job. Than you are the day after, or the day you were married, and the day after, or the day you were not injured, and the day after, you're still the same child of God. That's one of the great lessons out of Job, is that Job, he kind of recognizes that's his struggle. Who am I now? It's an identity issue. Who are you, God, and who am I? So I think that's why that book you did on purpose. That's really a book about identity, even though it's really designed to be about purpose, because purpose and identity and almost all the literature are so interrelated, right? Wow. Who you think you are is why you think you're here.
Wow. First of all, I'm so surprised you remember that from way back when, but thank you for that. But really, I love this.
Well, if any of us as authors could write that many books, okay, that you wrote that book the same year that I wrote Cold Case Christianity. That
My
was in
goodness.
2013. So that was, you know, and I just remember it because we were, I mean, I think our interviews probably go back pretty close to that far.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I remember we were both, you know, I always think of when an author's talking to another author, you kind of know what we go through. You know
what I mean? Exactly right.
What you have to do to get someone to read your silly book, you know?
Wow. Well, your book is
the truth of it.
None of your books are silly. They're so well researched, so well thought out. And this one, you're talking about the three ways to form your identity outside in. Very interesting. And how that really was more prevalent in times past. Inside out is so terrifying. I mean, you think of how that changes with the wind, and yet we're giving so much power to that and not, you know, helping young people know the path forward. Both of those unstable, topside down is the one stable way. That comes out of your chapter titled Fake IDs and Stolen Identity. And then yet you make it such a good point that even transitioning into something natural, like from your work years to retirement years, the enemy wastes no time going after identity and any kind of transition, you know, from one decade to the next. Or, you know, there's always some vulnerability when we're in transition. And then I think especially of these police officers, how the tide has turned against them that has got to have had such an incredible impact on their own sense of identity. They were once considered the heroes, and now they're a suspect, you know? And then they have crisis and trauma.
Yeah, and you're right. And this is just one chapter, but I'll tell you something. I got a friend named Joe Martin. He's got an online ministry, Dr. Joe Martin. You can look him up. But he always says this, and I thought this was brilliant when he first told me about it, that men are so tied up into our identity. He says, you know, men have conversations. And when they have conversations, identity is at the core. He says conversations between men, and you tell me this isn't true for women, I don't know. He says conversations for men are all about the Asians, conversation, A-T-I-O-N-S. He says the first Asian, because men will walk up to each other, shake each other's hand, and they'll say, I'm Jim Wallace, and you're so-and-so. What do you do? That's our first question usually of a stranger, of one man meeting another man. What do you do? And we don't care what you do. We care. We're asking, who are you? Because for us, those two things are inseparable. Who you are and what you do. So that first thing is occupation. That's the first Asian. We are aiming at occupation. And then, of course, if we're thinking to ourselves, well, okay, so how much money does that make? I mean, I know if you're a doctor and I'm just a, you know, I'm a cop, I'm probably, you're making more money than me. Compensation. That's the next way we're measuring our identities, our purpose, and our values. Third thing. Well, I know if you're a doctor, you probably have a pretty decent education. Education. That's the third way. Oh, are you a good doctor? Reputation. There's the fourth way. And then finally, cops are really bad about this. Even if all these guys in the room, if you are not making any money and you don't have an education, but you're 6'8" and cut like a Greek god, intimidation for men is as good as anything else. So the Asians are how we are looking at each other. And think about identity. Identity wouldn't matter unless there's more than one person involved. In other words, all identity is your effort to distinguish yourself from someone else. So every time you're thinking about identity, you're really doing it compared. You're always comparing to somebody else when you think about identity. And that's the problem for us, especially in a world where social media is so dominant, is that if you know, it's really easy. If your identity is not in Christ, it's really easy to feel inadequate because you're constantly comparing to the great life everyone else seems to be leading, the great purposes everyone else seems to be serving. So I think that that's just one chapter that I wanted to get out because I felt like so much of what I'm seeing in the work of injured officers, we did with military couples before this and even them, and then they're tragically injured in military. They come back and they're disabled for the rest of their lives. Now they're struggling. Like, who am I now? What do I do with this? So a lot of this book is about, you know, the issues about trauma, how to move past trauma. And you see a lot of that, of course, working murders.
Just a couple minutes before our bottom of the hour break, what are some of the ways that you've seen the light turn on for some of these injured folks who were once operating and functioning in this realm, and now because of trauma, tragedy, injury, they've got to make a change, they've got to adjust, and they're despondent, but you see maybe the light go on. How's that worked for you? Like, what has been the turning point for them where suddenly they think, this isn't the end for me, this is just a new normal?
Well, okay, that's a great point. And a lot of that is how you get to post-traumatic growth, right? Rather than post-traumatic stress disorder. And you see a lot of PTSD amongst military and police. But how you get to growth on the backside of the trauma is what the secularists call meaning-making. I call it meaning-finding. Because if you can figure out where this trauma fits in a bigger story that which you might benefit, well, how can I use this, leverage this? What good can come of this? Can I make sense of my suffering? People who do that, they actually experience growth on the backside of a trauma rather than reduce functionality forever. So how do we now, meaning finding, here's what I always say, is this thing you just suffered the last chapter in your story, or is there a larger story here? And this is the climactic chapter that's at the edge of something beautiful.
So good.
This is why Job doesn't even know what his story is. He doesn't know, am I going to die this way? Or is there something good still coming? And I think that's what when officers see that there might be a larger narrative, they are more likely to grow on the backside of trauma.
Wow. Talking to J. Warner Wallace again, the book is titled The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. We'll continue this conversation on the other side of the break. We've got a handful of copies to give away. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We're going to talk about what investigating death teaches us about the meaning of life. Such wisdom from J. Warner Wallace. We'll be back in a minute. Hope you're having a really great day. Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live. So honored to have J. Warner Wallace on the show today, celebrating the release of his new book, The Truth and True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. This book is packed with wisdom. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. It's one of those books that kind of weighs a lot. It's weighty. There's just so much in here. You know, Jim, people, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems people commit crimes based on a lie. Like they're seeing through a skewed lens. They're not reasoning in a reasonable way. So how does a person first go astray to the point that they find themselves on a criminal path? Because sometimes you'll see these reports and people around them are thinking, no, they were happy family members, successful in their community. I didn't see that coming. Right. But then a guy like you gets in there and all of a sudden you think, no, there's clues leading up to this. So unpack that if you would.
Well, there's one story in this book that I talk about that really every one of these stories is pretty practical, but there's always some underlying philosophical or theological issue, and a lot of it is idolatry. It's what do we choose to worship? Because it turns out God has given us a lot of good things that we have a tendency to worship instead of the God who gave them to us, and a lot of those are sex, money, and power. Those three motives are always underlying every crime that I work. Are based on those three things. And so when someone gets murdered, you ask the question, well, who could have benefited from one of those? Who would be motivated in one of those three areas? And the story I have in this book is of somebody who really, at first glance, you'd think, well, this guy had nothing to offer in any of those categories. So why would somebody kill him? And then you realize, wow, this is the person who did it, actually did find motive in two of those areas. Even though you and I might have said, well, my goodness, this guy didn't really have anything to offer in those two. But because we focus and we idolize, we end up look, all of us are going to worship. Everyone, whether you're religious or not, you worship. The question is, what are you worshiping? Because that's the focus. That's the thing you're going to spend all – it's going to control you. You'll be a slave to that thing that you hold in highest regard. And for people who hold power in high regard, well, then they're easily offended. They're easily offended when somebody, they think they've been snubbed or disrespected. Why? Because their authority, power, respect is overly important to them. If money is your thing, well, then you're liable to do things for money that other people wouldn't do. If sex is your thing, you'll never be satisfied. These are things that if we focus on them as our point of worship rather than the God who gave us these good things for a purpose, but when we focus on them as the object of our worship, we twist them. We always distort them in some way. We're like, we're stopping one level short of the object, the true object of worship, right? It's like we're worshiping the play rather than the playwright. And so I think in the end, that's what you see in these kinds of criminal cases. And the other thing, this is just one chapter. I wrote another chapter in this book. I had to, because I really felt like there's a cultural sense that humans are innately good. And when we fail, it's because we've been corrupted by something. We've been corrupted by a system, by our environment, by a culture, but we are born innocent. This is their view, the culture's view. And if that's the case, then all we have to do is maybe just control the environment a little better, control the system. This is why we see people who will say, hey, we need a better government system. If the other view is true, the biblical view, that no, it turns out we're not born innocent. We are fallen creatures that can corrupt any system we're placed in. We have the power to do that because that's who we are, including religious systems. We will corrupt those too, because any place you put fallen humans, they have the ability to mess up the system. And that's what I think you see. Like I remember doing a case one time. I don't know if this is even in the book, but maybe it is. I can't remember now. So many cases in the book. But I had a defense attorney who was just so certain that his client did not do this murder because he spent 30 years just as an upstanding citizen. I mean, did a lot of good for his community. And they were like, he was like, no, there's no way this guy. I mean, I've talked to him. He was certain. Now, of course, he did do it. And he ultimately confessed to it in court to help himself out. But why is he holding that view? Because we're often fooled. And if we think that people are innately, like we don't realize that you can put a happy face on your true nature. And if your true nature is fallen, at least you'll have a reasonable expectation for what humans are capable of. That's why when you work in cold cases, nobody is off the table. Everyone's a candidate because you know that there's always a deeper, darker. It's called the enigma of man. Yes, we're capable of doing great things. We're in God's image. We've been created in God's image, but we're also deeply fallen and rebellious. So just don't be surprised when someone who looks like they've been doing great things for years is capable of that. Also means, Susie, that all of us are capable of that. And just we haven't had the buttons pushed, you know, that they have.
Wow. Boy, good point. Because you put it yourself in enough stressful circumstances and getting your buttons pushed, it's, you know, horrifying to think of, you know.
Yeah. Well, how many times do you have a great day with your spouse and everything's going along? Well, because you've got no stress that day. And then someone introduces some small aspect of stress, right? And suddenly we're bickering.
The uglies.
We can't. Well, why does that happen? Well, because that's just our fallen nature. But if you know that, I don't hold that against anybody because I know that's who we are, right? It takes an extraordinary effort to, and this is why a worldview that offers, that calls you to something better, that empowers you with the Spirit of God, you've got a much better chance at being the kind of person you're supposed to be than if you don't embrace that worldview.
Who was it? Was it Moody, Tozer, Spurgeon? One of the famous dead guys, love them all. One of them said that our hearts are idol-making factories. And you said idolatry is just at the basis of crime. That's such an insightful thought. And
there's no doubt about it.
For us to walk in the fear of God, to say, Lord, show me, you know, in the smallest ways, what are the idols in my tent? What are the idols in my tent? Because remember when Joshua, the Lord said, the Lord's with you, be strong, be courageous, do not fear, you know, I'm with you. And then just a little bit later, he has a face off with this, what looks like a warrior. And he's like, are you a friend or a foe? And it was interesting. He said, neither. I'm an angel in the army of the Lord. That's my paraphrase. And he said, basically, take off your shoes. And I felt like what he was saying there was, you know, I mean, God just had told Joshua, I'm for you. But here he said, neither. And I pondered that, studied that. And what I understand that to mean is, are you for God? God is for you, but are you for God? Because there were people Joshua was leading that had idols in their tent, which would have caused him to lose the battle. And I think, you know, we're so sometimes so camped on, God is for me, God is for me. And I would just say, just because he's good to you, doesn't mean he's good with everything you do. And I think it's really worth taking inventory. Do we have idols in our tent?
That's a great, and that's, so in each one of these chapters, I try to do something called chase the lead. And what I'm trying to show is, okay, here's the issue. You see it in true crime. Here's what the studies say about this attribute of human behavior that we need to correct, that we need to address. And then this chase the lead section is, well, how would you identify? So in this particular chapter on worship, on this death of this guy named Santa Claus, as his nickname, well, okay, how would you identify your idols? And so I just have a series of questions. Some of them are pretty simple, right? Because the first three are really easy. Where do you spend your money? Where do you spend your time? Where do you spend your talent and ability? Because those are typically things that you think are worthy of your money, time, and talent. And so those are things you think are valuable. If you're spending those at church, it's because you think that's you. But maybe you're spending those in some other way, that your idol. Maybe it's your family. Maybe it's your marriage. Those things can be an idol. But then I go a little bit deeper. Like, what's captivating your thoughts? Where do you get your joy? What are the things, for example, that you say, I get to do this in 2 weeks? You're eagerly anticipating it. Good chance. What are you listening to in terms of music? You know, all music basically is an opportunity for us to worship something. What is the nature of your worship? What kind of music are you listening to? How about this? What do you trust? Whatever you trust, that ends up being your God. If you're trusting yourself, you're making yourself the object of salvation, the source of salvation. So what do you trust? Well, how do you identify yourself? This idea of our identity and how we walk up to somebody and what's on your bio? What's on your bio on your social media? Good chance your idols are on your bio. What do you publicly proclaim? Like, what kinds of t-shirts are you wearing? What kind of jewelry do you wear? But here's the ones I think are even the best. To what or to whom are you willing to submit your freedom? In other words, whatever you worship becomes your master. And we often are willing to have a master, and that will expose your idol. Like, you're willing to say, okay, I'm not free today. I have to do X. Well, that's because you worship that thing you're doing, more than likely. What are you unwilling to question? What's the one thing that if someone like pushes back on it, you'll get really upset? This is outside of being questioned. There's an idol. What makes you? What's the thing that gets you most angry when you watch it on TV? Or you're just scratching a surface of an idol. So I think we could dig deeper into the things that we think are of ultimate importance, because those things master us, and so we have to be careful about what those things are. In the story in the book, I just talk about how this guy was a homeless member of our community who didn't have any money. He was an old guy who looked like Santa Claus. He didn't have anything you would think ordinarily in the sex, money, and power. But it turned out he had offended somebody because he was getting cans and recyclables out of a part of town that really was kind of overlapping somebody else's kind of territory. So he was impacting their income source. And when he was confronted on it, he kind of blew the guy off. So he had triggered in that one moment two of the three motives, right? He was taking his money. He saw it as I'm losing revenue, this killer. And he said also, you disrespected me in front of all of our community. So it was a power issue. And for that, he was willing to kill this old man. Now, think about that for a second. That's when you have elevated money and power to a level where it is it's your master. And if it's your master, the smallest provocation will trigger something terrible.
Wow. All the more reason, friends, to walk in a healthy fear of God and to know if our hearts truly are idol-making factories, which I think they are. This isn't about sin management or constantly editing ourselves, but to humbly bring ourselves before God to say, show me what I can't see. Show me my heart. What are the things I make so much compensation for that if those things are poked at in my life or threatened in any way, you see a side of me that I'm not proud of? God set me free. Yeah. I think it's just worth asking that question. On the other side of the break, Jim, I want to talk about the difference between suspicion and discernment. I borrowed this phrase from an old friend, but I love reading. You know, I read so many nonfiction books for my job that when I'm traveling on my flight home from events, I'll read like a Christian suspense novel. And my hubby's like, you have literally developed a spiritual gift of suspicion. You know, I'm looking at, you know, seeing conspiracy everywhere and all of that. But and we laugh about that. But truly, though, especially someone like you in the field that you've been in, how easy it would be to get jaded. And I do think there are a lot of Christians who live suspicious and they do not see through a lens of love or faith or hope or anything. But that's different than walking in discernment. So talking to J. Warner Wallace again, we got a handful of copies of his book, The Truth in True Crime. This is such a unique layout and really interesting stories and biblical parallels and biblical lessons. Really powerful. What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. We'll be back in a minute. Hi, I'm Suzy Larson, host of Suzy Larson Live. And I just have to pause, take a deep breath, and say thank you. With all my heart, thank you. You often hear me say, we can't do this without you, and we absolutely wouldn't want to. It's more important than ever that we be bold for Jesus, because we believe and know He's the hope of the earth, and you helped us do just that. So thank you for partnering with us so that we can partner with God to change the world. And if you've not given yet, you still have a chance to join us on this mission field. You can give now, safe and secure online, at myfaithradio.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live. We have our friend J. Warner Wallace on the show today, celebrating the release of his brand new book, The Truth in True Crime, What Investigating Death Teaches Us About the Meaning of Life. And in each chapter, he tells these stories, investigations so interesting, and then makes a biblical application for us. And before the break, you know, you were talking about, you know, you're a cold case detective. You've had to, and how many times did people never suspect somebody who was an upstanding member of society and they ended up being guilty? On one hand, I'm wondering how you kept from getting jaded and suspicious of everyone. But truly, as believers, I do feel like there's a lot of assigning motives, a lot of quick to judge, you know, ready, shoot, aim kind of. There is a lot of that. And we're called to be wise as serpents, innocent as doves. So talk about, maybe even make the distinction between kind of an unhealthy suspicion and true discernment.
Oh, gosh. Okay, well, first of all, that is, you're asking somebody who's generally pretty pessimistic. And I always say that if you assume everyone's a liar, eventually someone goes to jail. If you assume everyone's a truth teller, no one ever goes to jail. So I typically have to take that approach. If you want to pursue an investigation, or if you really wanted to do the most, like look at, for example, if you were to take a self-defense course, they could teach you how to grapple. They could teach you all those things. But the first thing they're probably likely to teach you is situational awareness. They're probably likely to say, hey, don't put yourself in that situation to begin with. assume the worst possible scenario. When you go out into that parking lot, look around and say, well, where are the five or six places that someone could kill me from? Now, that's a bad way to kind of live your life, right? Because you're always looking at the negative. What's the worst case scenario? But if you lived your life from a worst case scenario perspective, you probably would never be injured. You probably would never find yourself having to defend yourself because you're constantly saying, hey, I'm just not going to go over there because I can see that's a potential threat. That's a potential threat. That's a potential threat. So my problem typically, and this is, you start some patrol. I was just talking about this with Lisa Childers, who wrote the foreword on this book, because people will call me for advice. What happens is in patrol is you're driving down the street to a call, a domestic violence call, and it's in a regular neighborhood, like the kind of neighborhood you live in, and you pull up to that house and you get inside and you realize what a mess is going on in this house. What a relationship mess, all the dangers, all the messiness. You get to see it. And it just happens over and over and over again to the point where you can't help but drive down the street and look at all the houses and think, is everyone like this? I mean, there's a nightmare probably every third or fourth house. Of course, there isn't. But you've been conditioned to think this because what you're seeing, you're being overly saturated with negativity. So there's a chapter in this book where I talk about the nature of God's love. The nature of God is that he is the fullness of truth and grace. And this is why when John is describing Jesus coming in the fullness of truth and grace, that's a claim to deity. It's in chapter 1 of John, which is the entire chapter is about a claim to deity of Jesus, that Jesus is God who creates the world. Nothing is created outside of what Jesus creates. All of this is in chapter 1, and he says that Jesus comes in the fullness of truth and grace because that only one being is the fullness of truth. Now, the rest of us either are too judgmental, we overly discern, or we're too gracious, we accept anything. But God balances those two things. And all of Scripture is the authors trying to tell us, hey, guys, you need to be more loving. Or, hey, guys, you need to be more discerning. Because we don't hold those two things in balance. But if we can learn to hold those two things in balance. And so I know as somebody who finds by my nature now in this job, I'm overly judgmental. I know that I have to pull up to fullness the grace side. I just know that about myself. But if you're somebody who like never wants to offend, well, you probably need to pull up the truth side because you're probably all about, you know, getting along. And the love of God is this. I think we think if to love like God, it's all about grace and mercy. No. It says God is love. God equals love. It also says God is the fullness of truth and grace, justice and mercy. So that equal sign, God is equal to both of those things. You can take God out of that equation. That means that love, from God's perspective, is the fullness of truth and grace. So we have to have truth. The love is meaningless. It's a platitude. It's like saying, I love everything. Well, then you really don't love anything because you're not being just about what you're applying your affections toward. So I think it's important for us to be able to hold both of those. So it's no, for me, I have to be careful not to be more gracious and not quite as judgmental. That's my nature.
That's so good. I was thinking as you're talking, Jim, that of some of these high-profile leaders, that the ministries were built around personalities, and then you come to find out things that are, you know, horrific, and people look back and say, you know, I had a check in my spirit, or I was discerning something, but I second-guessed it because everybody was on the train. Everybody was, you know, saying, he's
so
the guy.
True. And, yes, so true. We've seen that so many times in the last 5 years, right? I mean, and I don't want to be the jerk who says, oh, there's something's not right here. But that spider sense, you know, Spider-Man sense is actually helpful sometimes. Unfortunately, for my job, it's always better to start off thinking everyone's a liar until proven otherwise than the converse of that. So that's just a tool. But it also means you can't live your life that way. You can't live your personal relationships that way. You can't parent that way. You can't be a spouse that way. But in terms of this, what we're doing here, which is investigating cases, that's different. You have to put a different skill set in place.
Yeah. Wow. So for us to walk in, you know, grace and truth, spirit and in truth too, led by the spirit, discerning truth, I think, even as we apply that in our just everyday life, you know, loving people well, but never checking discernment at the door. And Yeah, I just think that's such good stuff. So I've got a handful of pages left of my notes that we haven't even touched yet. So I'm hoping you'll come back soon.
I would love to.
I hope you. All right, Angela will send you some dates and we'll continue our conversation. I know by the texts that have come in, people have so appreciated this time. Jim, thanks for all that you do for the kingdom and to help so many people heal. God bless you.
Thanks, Susie, for having me. You know how much I appreciate your work. Thanks again.
Yeah, we appreciate you. J. Warner Wallace is my guest. His book, The Truth and True Crime. We'll leave that drawing open if you want to text the word book to get in on the drawing. 877-933-2484. We'll pick up this conversation when he gets on in the next month or two. Looking forward to that conversation as well. We love and appreciate you so much. Walk in love. Walk in discernment. Stay close to the Lord. Stay in the Word. And trust Him with your whole heart. I'll meet you back here next time. Thank you for listening to this conversation from Susie Larson Live. These conversations are available because of your support. You could become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes, and then share it with friends so together we can all have a deeper life in Christ.